copays. We've got to work it out, folks. We've got to work it out. Hey, you're listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. Thanks for being with us today. I want to thank our guest, David Swanson. Great guest as always. Don't forget, you've heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the...
This is the Quality News Network. A high-ranking Democrat proposed legislation to begin bringing U.S. troops home in 120 days and end combat by the end of April 2008. The measure, spearheaded by Senator Carl Levin, chairman of the Armed Services Committee, would allow for some troops to stay in Iraq on counterterrorism efforts. Senator John McCain's presidential run suffered a major setback today with the resignation of his campaign manager and political strategist. The shakeup comes 6 months before Iowa caucuses. McCain's popularity dropped significantly this year as he embraced President Bush's troop increase for the Iraq War. The president is expected to defend his Iraq War strategy while in Cleveland today. Senior administration officials say Bush does not plan to make any changes to his Iraq plan, despite growing disapproval from both Democrats and Republicans. The White House says the last of the additional troops just arrived 2 weeks ago and calls for withdrawal are premature. In Islamabad, a leading radical cleric from the pro-Taliban Red Mosque was killed when he refused to surrender. After negotiations broke down earlier today, Pakistani troops stormed the compound, killing the cleric and 60 militants. 8 soldiers were also killed during the raid. 8 days ago, militant students took the mosque and hostages as part of the campaign to impose Islamic law in the capital city. Six-party talks with North Korea will likely resume next week in Beijing. The UN's nuclear watchdog agency is preparing to send inspectors to Pyongyang to observe the dismantling of the country's nuclear weaponry program. On Capitol Hill, the chairman of the House and Senate Judiciary Committees say the president's use of executive privilege will have to be decided in court. Yesterday, the president evoked executive privilege and denied the testimony of former administration officials subpoenaed to testify in the hearings related to the firing of 8 U.S. attorneys. In New Jersey, federal prosecutors are petitioning the court to keep the names of potential jury members in the Fort Dix terrorism trial secret. Attorneys say jurors may be fearful of reprisal because of the 6 international publicity surrounding the case. In Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, legislators and the governor resolved the state's budget crisis last night. Yesterday, nearly a third of the state's workforce was temporarily laid off as a result of the budget impasse. New York is bracing for the first heat wave of the season. You're listening to the Quality News Network. Science and business are up next.
Here's good news about your money. Monterey County Bank has won the Bauer Financial 5-Star Superior Rating for financial strength and stability, making it one of the safest banks in Monterey County for your money. It's nice to know your money is in a safe place, but there are even more reasons to bank with Monterey County Bank. They now have 4 convenient locations in Carmel, Monterey, Carmel Valley, and Pacific Grove. And Monterey County Bank is the oldest locally owned bank, now celebrating its 30th anniversary serving you. Here's another important point. Local businesses have come to trust and rely on Monterey County Bank's position as the county's number one SBA small business lender. Safety, convenience, and local people you can trust. That's Monterey County Bank. Stop in at one of our 4 branches and find out why you can bank on us. Monterey County Bank, SBA preferred lender and equal housing lender, member FDIC.
A team from the California Institute of Technology has found glimpses of the most distant and oldest galaxies ever seen. The team used a giant Keck telescope in Hawaii to make the discovery and view the light that has been traveling for billions of years. Researchers say Pfizer's anti-smoking drug Chantix may eventually be used to curb alcoholism and other addictions. The medicine affects the brain's so-called pleasure center. China today executed the former head of its Food and Drug Administration. Beijing said the official's corruption resulted in a recent series of contaminated pharmaceuticals, pet food, children's toys, and toothpaste. In Zimbabwe, 33 executives have been arrested and more than 1,300 companies fined for refusing the government's order to cut prices in half. Zimbabwe's inflation rate is between 5 and 9,000%, the highest in the world. Home Depot forecast a 15% decline in its earnings per share. The world's largest home improvement store chain cited the housing slump and sale of its wholesale distribution business. It is the most expensive residential real estate listing in the country. In Beverly Hills, California, William Randolph Hearst's 29-bedroom pink stucco mansion is being offered for $165 million. Consumer borrowing surged to nearly $13 billion in May, the largest increase in 6 months. The 6.4% jump was twice what the Federal Reserve had originally predicted. This is QNN.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Well, it looks like the Democratic bill that gave Bush supplemental funding for the Iraq War and contained a bunch of non-binding benchmarks actually is having some bite. Despite the fact that I and virtually every progressive condemned the bill for giving Bush what he wanted in a binding fashion and benchmarks only being advisory, they actually seem to be doing something. As it becomes increasingly clear that the Iraqi occupation is out of control, that the administration has no hope of meeting the July benchmarks, much less the September benchmarks, even Republicans are starting to desert the sinking ship. But as we discuss the war in Iraq and how to get out, it's always important to remember how we got in and to give the inside scoop on that so that we know exactly who it is running this country and to prevent making such mistakes in the future. Last month, I had the really terrific opportunity to go to the Take Back America convention, the largest convention of progressives in Washington, D.C. And at that time, I got the distinct pleasure of interviewing David Korn, Larry Korb, and Medea Benjamin. I want to play those interviews for you today. But it is a live show, and if you want to call in and discuss any of these topics with me, I'm glad to hear it. I'd like to talk about it with you. We can put off an interview till another show. I'd rather hear from you. Let me start, though, with David Korn. David Korn is the Washington editor of The Nation magazine and the co-author of Hubris, the inside story of spin, scandal, and the selling of the Iraq War.
I'm sitting now with David Korn of The Nation. David Korn is the author of Hubris, which has just come out in paperback. David Korn, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thanks for having me, Mark. And let me say I'm co-author of Hubris.
Excuse me.
The subtitle is The Inside Story of Spin, Scandal, and the Selling of the Iraq War. My co-author is Michael Isikoff, the wonderful investigative reporter from Newsweek.
Now, in Hubris, it talks about how this war was sold.
Yes.
And how they, I mean, it's not just like they lied about weapons of mass destruction. This was a selling campaign.
Yes, I mean, people might remember the quip that Andrew Card made shortly in August or beginning of September 2002 when he says, you don't bring a new product to market in the summertime. It was right when they were, you know, ginning up a sales campaign. And what we did in the book was, which the book is no screed, it's a behind-the-scenes narrative of what was going on at the White House, the CIA, the State Department, and even on Capitol Hill in the months before, even after the war, when it came to to that sales job. And it's still, you know, the ad campaign that the publisher put out for the paperback edition that just came out a couple of days ago, the headline was "How They Got Away with It," and to me, that's still the big story here: how they got away with it.
How did they get away with it? It seems like they tricked at least half the Democratic Party as well as all the Republicans.
And all the Republicans and much. Though not all, but much of the media. And one story that resonates, still resonates for me out of the book that we retold, I think, for the first time in full glory, was the story of the aluminum tubes. People might remember that one of the big selling points was that Saddam Hussein was close to obtaining nuclear weapons. And the biggest piece of evidence there was that Iraq had purchased aluminum tubes. And you might remember Dick Cheney going on Meet the Press in the fall of 2002, weeks before the vote on the war authority that Congress would give to Bush, and saying, hey, you know, what's the evidence? Answering Tim Russ's question, you don't have to believe me. Go look at the front page of the New York Times today. It was a story about the aluminum tubes. Both Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice and others in the administration said these tubes could only be used for one thing, the enrichment of uranium, which you only enrich uranium if you want to build a bomb. So here was, you know, concrete evidence, hard evidence, not supposition. We knew that they had these tubes.
An aluminum tube,
you know,
which apparently can be used for crop dusting or any kinds of other things.
But what they didn't tell the public, this is what we tell in the book, was that at the time they were making those statements, the government's top experts on nuclear weaponry, people working in the Department of Energy and at the nuclear labs, like Oak Ridge and others across the nation, Los Alamos, they had been in a debate for over a year on whether these tubes were for nuclear weapons programs or not, and all the top experts had agreed, they'd reached consensus, that they were not. They were not the right specifications, and this was a highly...
Where was this consensus? Was it in the National Intelligence Estimate or somewhere else?
Well, this was among the people working in the DOE.
Was there a written report?
Well, what happened... They actually had put out some reports, but there was no government-wide report. At the CIA, there was primarily one analyst who didn't have the technical skill or background or academic record that all these other experts had, but he believed that there was indeed, that this was, the tubes were indeed destined for uranium enrichment and could only be used for that. And it was his
analysis. One guy at the CIA who didn't have the background.
And it was his analysis that ended up trumping everybody else. And what happened was when the scientists saw Dick Cheney and Condi Rice and others making this argument, they knew they were lying. And they, some thought, we've interviewed these people for the book, some thought about coming out and speaking publicly, but they were told if they did, they would lose their jobs. And, these are, mid-level or middle-aged people. They had kids in college, and they felt terrible. They tried to leak some information on this to the Washington Post. The Post published a very small piece because the editors at the Post thought the reporter was upset about being scooped on the aluminum tube story. And now was trying to, do his own little personal hit back against the New York Times that had the aluminum tube story first.
What about the New York Times? Was it Judith Miller who was feeding most of this misinformation? Why didn't they get the story right?
The interesting thing about the piece that came out with the aluminum tubes in it had a double byline, Michael Gordon and Judith Miller. But it was Michael Gordon who had done the aluminum tubes portion of the article. And he was a reporter who had long taken a cynical, skeptical, sometimes challenging approach to the Pentagon. But he had sources who were obviously getting the wrong channel of intelligence here being fed to them, and they gave this to him, and so he went with it. And, it was very hard for him, to be fair, to sort of get the other side.
So leaking, basically, the information.
This was not a planted leak. People within the administration, his sources, mid-level people, had heard about the reporting, the conclusion that the CIA had come to, and maybe we're not aware of what the DOE had come to, and they passed that information on to him. But what happened afterward was that some scientists outside the government, aware of the internal debate and aware that the real experts had debunked this, tried to get the New York Times to do a second story, basically correcting itself, and that story was written by Judy Miller, and she botched it. She her sources came back and said, no, we're right on this. And so she didn't give full weight to the existence of this debate and to the fact that the true experts in the government had taken the opposite view of what the Times had reported and what the administration was saying. So on the second round, that was her fault and not Michael Gordon's fault because he didn't work so much on that story.
Let me ask you this. We've done a lot of work on whistleblowers. We have a lot of them here on the Inside Scoop.
Yeah.
You're saying that people told these scientists they would be fired if they told the truth to the press. Two questions. One, would they have been protected under the Whistleblower Act? I don't know if you know the answer to that question.
Yeah.
And number two, who told them they'd be fired?
Well, these are their superiors at the Department of Energy.
Do we have names? I mean...
I don't know. I don't think we name them in the book. I'm not sure we know the names. We named the scientists. You can always go back and...
I'm just trying to figure out how high it goes. Yeah. Is it just the superiors, or is it all the way from the top, Cheney on down?
Well, I don't think it came from the White House. What happened was, as I mentioned, there was a little squib in the Washington Post that mentioned that the scientists at the DOE might disagree. The Post story was kind of weak. And when that story came out, the word came down from the top, as the scientists saw it, you better not be talking to the press about this. And so the way bureaucracies work, it could just be a it could be just someone in the communications office of the Department of Energy realizing, oh my God, here we have some DOE people challenging what the administration is saying. I'm sending out the word, don't do this. It doesn't have to come from the White House, which is why the White House wants to have political appointees running the PR
sure.
shops and the communications. They're supposed to look out for things like this. And I mean, it is, I think, one of the more poignant stories that Michael Isikoff and I tell in our book, Hubris, because the scientists were highly conflicted. They felt bad about this. They saw the public being informed. They wanted to be good public servants, but there was a high hurdle. They would have to sacrifice their job to do this. And Mark, as you know from your work with whistleblowers, a lot of that's a pretty big price to ask people to pay.
Sure.
And
look at what they did to Richard Clark.
Yeah, and whistleblowers who do come forward often get penalized, and they go through tremendous psychological traumas. And the protections that that do exist under the law for them often are weak or often are circumvented. And so in this instance, I'm not sure if they, there's sort of a double whammy that, they were told, in essence, that if, you spoke publicly or talked to the press, you'd have your clearance pulled. You wouldn't be able to have any access to classified information.
Yeah, that
which would destroy their job, no question about it. Because not just in the... Because even if
they left their job, they couldn't go to a new job.
If they left the government
and
went to the private sector, they would still need their clearance to do the work they do. So this is not just saying, well, I'll sacrifice my government job and find a job in the private
sector. Destroy your career.
This means you have no more career. And even if there are on paper protections in this regard, people have seen enough examples of people who haven't been thoroughly protected that there's not the faith in the system. So,
David, let me ask you this.
Ahead.
Whenever you talk about the war, whenever I talk about the war with Iraq, and I have a lot of Republicans on the show, whenever we talk about the beginning, first of all, they never want to talk about how the war began. They want to talk about, well, it's a mess now, and it'll be a mess whether we leave or stay. Okay.
Yeah.
But when you talk about how the war began, the universal spin line is, well, everyone believed there were weapons of mass destruction. That maybe there weren't, but everyone believed it at the time.
Yeah, which isn't true.
Is that true?
No, it's not true, especially if you break it down.
Who believed it and who didn't?
Well, if you look at the National Intelligence Estimate that the CIA produced only because the Democrats insisted there be one in the fall of 2002, the headline does say Iraq has biological and chemical weapons.
Doesn't mention nuclear, does it?
It says it's developing nuclear weapons, but probably take 10 years sooner if left unchecked. But Iraq obviously was checked, so no one was advocating leaving it unchecked in the nuclear realm. But if you look at the NIE and you dig into it, you see that the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, also produced a report in the fall of 2002 saying that it had no hard evidence of chemical weapons stockpiles in Iraq. So even though the intelligence community consensus was that they have them, there was no... They also was the recognition, we have no hard evidence. Before the war, actually before the run-up to the war in early 2001, Colin Powell gave a press conference in Egypt.
That's right.
And it was on the State Department website saying that we believe we have Saddam boxed in.
February 01.
And that he's weak. And he's not a significant WMD threat. Admiral Wilson, Thomas Wilson, who was the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, testified in our book Hubris. I think we were like the first to give any real attention to this testimony. It was public testimony, but didn't get any attention at the time. He testified, I think it was in March of 2001, on the threats to the United States, an annual threat assessment that the DIA and the CIA give to Congress. And Iraq didn't even make the list. And he said,
When was this?
In March of 2001, I believe.
March 01, okay.
But early 01, before 9/11. And, Iraq didn't even make the top five. And he said, its WMD program was weak. And he told us in an interview that he didn't believe that Iraq was a WMD threat. It was a WMD problem.
It was a problem there are many rogue states in the world, and they're all
problem.
Trying to do stuff.
We didn't want him to have developed that. He had him in the past.
Right.
And it's true that he'd gotten further along than people had thought in the past, which is why getting inspectors in and keeping him, on guard was the right way to go.
Let me ask you this. the inspectors, when they came back in 02, people never talk about that. In fact, I even remember George Bush afterwards saying he didn't let the inspectors in as if he amnesia or something.
Mitt Romney said that just the other day.
You know, I mean, he didn't let them in 98, but in 02, they were in. Did they have full access at that time?
Well, 98, actually, he didn't kick them out. They were pulled out by the Clinton administration because there were problems in about where they could go and what was happening.
He was playing games with them.
He was playing games with them, and then Clinton decided to have an attack, and he pulled the inspectors out before the attack. But, you know, but just the other day, Mitt Romney said, you know, we had to go to war because you wouldn't let the inspectors in.
I mean, Bush has said that. And yet I was around in 02. Well, I remember those inspectors.
People don't remember that the system was working. And liberals don't want to, you know, remember, too, that to a certain degree, the vote to authorize war, you know, help get the inspectors in. After that war came out.
It was the threat to use force. Yes. I mean, that's the thing that's never talked about in the vote authorization by liberals or conservatives. Yeah. It was not a vote to approve the war in Iraq.
It was a threat of force that got the inspectors in. And very quickly, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about the aluminum tubes. They quickly, you know, resolved that issue. They saw the tubes, you know, and they went to the tubes and they said these tubes are for rocket launchers, not for nuclear weapons. And they got access to all the sites. And if you remember, you know, Hans Blix's statements at the time, he was raising issues. He wanted to talk to certain scientists. He wanted to, you know, but on access to sites, there was not a problem. Then they found a small number of weapons that violated the ban on weapons that could travel a certain distance. And they had a discussion with Saddam Hussein's regime about whether they did or did not violate. But come March 2003, you know, Blix was reporting that, you know, it was giving Saddam Hussein basically a B+ on cooperation, saying there were still more issues to resolve, and of course saying we haven't found anything significant. And on the nuclear issue, on the tubes, they had fully, you know, there was no longer the notion that they'd look for uranium in Niger had been debunked already, and the tubes had been debunked. So
and the tractor trailers and everything else.
Things were actually going pretty well.
Colin Powell has said, after the 2004 election, that the biggest mistake he regrets in his public career was that famous United Nations speech where he's playing with the he's got tubes in his hand and claims, you know, biological weapons and so forth. When did Colin Powell realize he'd been tricked? Was it before the 2004 election? Did he have a chance to come forward publicly before 2004?
Yeah. I mean, he actually talked to us for the book. And
before the election.
No, after the election.
After
he talked
election.
To us for the book I did with Issachar, Hubris, in which, you know, he was very pissed off about the speech. He was pissed off at the CIA, which basically wrote most of the speech, but he was also pissed off that he's gotten so much blame. You know, it's like, well, how come, you know, Bush said the same things? Congress voted for the war.
But we trust you, Colin Powell. You're not Bush. You know, we know he lied to us.
Literally, he said, why is it Colin Powell gave a speech and not these other guys? So he's still
because you used to be an honest man, Colin Powell. That's why.
Well, you know,
he's still more honest by standards.
By Washington
standards, right. But when did he realize?
Well, listen. In October 2003, David Kaye, you know, comes back and gives an interim report saying we haven't found anything. David Kaye, starting in July of 2003, is reporting back to the CIA and to the government and is briefing Bush. We have this great scene in our book in which David Kaye comes back in the end of July and briefs Bush and says, haven't found anything. And certainly not those biological mobile labs that Colin Powell put so much emphasis on. And Bush basically, according to Kaye, is completely unperturbed by this. Kaye walked out of the meeting utterly stunned, saying that he never saw anybody at that height of government who was less curious. And it just made him think, I don't know what this guy's thinking.
Paul O'Neill had the exact same comment about George Bush. And a totally separate incident.
Yeah. But so we describe this. So Colin Powell, early on,
he knew long before the election.
In fact, now that I think about it, the DIA and the INR, the State Department intelligence guys, were out there, disagreeing with a CIA report that came out at the end of May 2003 saying that they had found the biological weapons trucks. And the CIA rushed out an analysis, and it was a State Department intelligence that a guy named Carl Ford, who ran the INR, again, another great story in our book, but sort of behind-the-scenes stuff, he went ape, you know what. He just went bat crazy, saying that it was bad intelligence analysis. Couldn't believe the CIA put it out. So Colin Powell, who was his boss, knew he was the anyone in the inside had these indications pretty early on. Certainly by 04, he knew that he had been had. He probably knew he had been had within the summer of 03.
Why did these stories come out? By at least, okay, maybe Colin Powell, I suspect he believed what he said when he said it at the United Nations. But pretty soon after, he knows he's been tricked. You have all these people that know they've been tricked. Did the American public know? I mean, I was reporting things too, but did the widespread mainstream press, I don't recall hearing they lied to us about this war, at least not before the election of 04.
Well, you know, there were people out there, because the October report, interim report, saying we haven't found anything, was public, and then he testified in January 2004. He said we all were wrong. No, not all. I like David Kay, and he helped a lot in the book, but we weren't all wrong.
We were lied to.
Some people were lied to. Some people actually saw it, you know, came to the right conclusions before the war. And so this stuff was out there. What you had in the, you know, in 04, in 03, and then the beginning of 04 leading up to the election was, you know, story after story, revelation after revelation. I was covering this of things that were wrong with the pre-war account, showing that they had either lied or been completely irresponsible in what they had said. Yet there was this continual, you know...
You didn't see front page of the New York Times. You didn't see front page of the Washington Post.
There was a continual debate in the, you know, in the commentariat about what this meant, and maybe we'll find, you know, give him, you know, Bush kept saying give him more time, you know, we may find something, we're still looking, it's not over yet. And the Republicans sort of, you know, circled the wagon, as, you know, and war supporters did, and the and I think the papers didn't, you know, I think you're right, didn't give as much attention or importance to these stories as they should have, but it was certainly out there for anybody, you know, who cared to look.
David Korn, I love your level of detail. It's the kind of thing that I really like to get here on the Inside Scoop. Where can someone get the paperback of Hubris? On Amazon or bookstores?
Amazon,
or?
It's everywhere. It's out everywhere. And they just heard from the publisher. The first week of sales have been pretty strong. They're happy about this. And the best thing about the book is actually has a wonderful jacket, which I had nothing to do in the design. But it's out everywhere. And if people want to go to my website, which is davidkorn.com, it's Korn with a C, there's a very easy buy this book link that takes you to Amazon. So please look for it there, and think about reading it.
David, thanks for coming here on the Inside Scoop.
Thank you, Mark.
Well, you heard it. One of the things I really like about David Korn, of course, is all the detail. And anytime you have a question about who knew what when, I highly urge you to go out and buy the book Hubris or just listen to this interview. It'll be archived at RadioInsideScoop.com. When we come back, I've got another guest that I detail interview with. His name is Larry Korb. He is with the Center for American Progress, but interestingly used to work for the Reagan administration, and he describes how it wasn't that he left the Republicans, but the Republicans left him. Back with the interview of Larry Korb right after this. If you want to call in, folks, and comment on anything you've heard, I always encourage you to do so. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK. We'll be right back after this.
Sweetie, I love you, but those jeans have got to go.
Yeah, I know. Grab me a pair next time you go to the store, would you?
No.
Huh?
I'm not going there anymore. I can't stand it.
What do you mean?
It's just awful, honey. The only smile in that building is that big yellow face. Everybody else looks miserable, and I can't find anything there that's made in our country. That bothers me.
Well, nobody makes clothes in America anymore.
Au contraire, mi amigo. There's a ton of American-made clothing at No Sweat.
Well, where's this No Sweat store? Out at the mall?
No, silly. I found them at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a link there. I already ordered some great workout gear, and I also got you some new jeans. They'll be here in a couple of days. Surprise.
HeadOnRadioNetwork.com?
Uh-huh. Just click on the No Sweat banner. You're right there. Helps union workers and helps support America's other liberal network. Cool, huh?
I knew listening to the horn was a good idea.
Whose idea?
Your idea, dear. All the good ones are.
Union made? No sweat. Great prices? No sweat. Great looks? No sweat. No sweat at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Click the banner. Do the right thing.
It wasn't exactly planes, trains, and automobiles on Head On with Bob Kincaid.
This is what the Bush administration Justice Department didn't want you to see back in 2001. They took out and they huffed the marker a little bit, and then they went, oh, cool. And they wiped out the name where it says the plane was chartered either by the Saudi Arabian royalty family or Osama bin Laden. Somebody's got to call up and say, good afternoon. Thank you for calling Ryan International Flights. How may I help you? Hello. This is Osama bin Laden, and I would like to rent a Boeing 727. Do you have one handy? Oh, just a moment. Let me check. It's a Mr. bin Laden wants to know if we got a 727. Do we, Harry, do we have a 727? Yeah, we got a 727 just sitting there on the lot. Going cheap. There's nothing here. Nothing to look at. Keep moving. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. The, you know, the 6 foot 7 inch Arab with the portable dialysis machine and the white robes.
Head On with Bob Kincaid, weeknights, 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern, only on the Head On Radio Network.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop as we figure out how we're going to get out of this mess that is the Iraqi occupation that has cost thousands of American lives and hundreds of thousands of Iraqi lives and hundreds of billions of dollars. It's important to recognize how we got in it in the first place, how we're conducting the war, how it is, in fact, that we have contractors doing all of our dirty work. And to get the inside scoop on that, I invited Larry Korb to interview with me. Interestingly enough, he, although he now works for Center for American Progress, he used to work for Ronald Reagan. Here was my interview with Larry Korb.
Sitting before me now is Larry Korb. He works for the Center for American Progress, but what might interest you is he was an Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. Sounds like you've come 180 degrees from that time.
No, actually, the Republicans have changed an awful lot. Remember that when Reagan made a mistake in Lebanon, he knew enough to get out, did not stay embroiled in the civil war. And the Republicans have changed. I mean, Eisenhower would never have gotten us involved in this mess in Iraq. He resisted the calls from the French to get us involved in Vietnam back in the 50s. So
let me ask you about Eisenhower's most famous words regarding the military, where he talked about the military-industrial complex. To what extent is the military-industrial complex controlling what we do in Iraq today?
Well, I think it has a big influence on how much we spend on defense. They took advantage of September 11 to increase the regular defense budget. I'm not talking about the budget for fighting the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but their normal defense budget has gone from $300 to $500 billion under this administration. Donald Rumsfeld basically allowed the services to buy every weapon system in sight, and he made a few minor cancellations, but compared to previous secretaries of defense, just let the thing get out of hand.
What about the role of contractors? I've had a lot of veterans on my show, and one of the things, frankly, that they most resent is that they're paid, you know, a fair, I guess, decent salary, while contractors are making $200,000-$300,000 to, in the words of, as one veteran put it to me, to do half the work we do with less than half the risk.
Well, the problem you have is that this administration never prepared for a long war in Iraq. They refused to send enough troops, and so they've used the contractors as a fill-in. And they resisted calls on the part of particularly Democrats in the Congress to increase the size of the Army. So you have no choice but to use contractors, because you simply don't have enough military people to rotate them in and out at a reasonable number. And hopefully, after this mess is over, we'll sit back and lay down some criteria for using contractors.
Are they making unfair profits? I mean, we know about the no-bid contracts with Halliburton. Are there a lot of, I don't know if it was the Reagan administration where they had $1,000 toilet seats and things like that?
$600.
Excuse me, $600. You were there. I you know, you remember it. Is it worse now?
Oh, I think it's much worse because, again, Rumsfeld, we now know, was a terrible manager. He didn't, I mean, all the weapon systems prices just got way out of hand. There was no real overseeing. And his deputy, Paul Wolfowitz, as we know, is not a very good manager either. So spending on weapon systems just got out of control. But, you know, the question about contracts, I think, is very important. What happened is this administration took a good idea and let it get out of hand. When you go to a volunteer military, you're going to pay people a reasonable salary compared to, like, when I went in the draft. I mean, we were paid, you know, $86 a month. So what you want to do is...
Not $86 a month.
Yes, it was.
You were paid less than $1,000 a year?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, under the draft, you started, and then when I got my commission, we went up to $220 a month, okay?
Because what decade are we talking about?
We're talking about the 60s.
You're kidding.
No.
I never knew that.
Sure. Well, I mean, what the draft was, we call it, was really the hidden tax of conscription. So, essentially, in fact, I took a cut. I was a New York City high school teacher, and I took a cut when I went into the service. So, but what it's one thing to have them, you know, do what the Army would call KP, or kitchen police, the cooking. That you should be doing. But they shouldn't be guarding convoys. They shouldn't be firing at people. I was just recently in Iraq in the first part of April, and I had two security guards there, former South African military people. And I asked them, I said, well, what will you do if you blow your horns and people don't move over? They said, well, shoot them. I said, no, what authority, you know? I mean, and that's really, we got to...
Yeah, I mean, who's the president? Kellogg Brown Root? Did they tell him what to do?
Well, interesting, when we were waiting to go into Iraq, we got on this long line to go through the customs, and this whole bunch of people went around, and I said, hey, who are they? And the guy said, oh, they're Halliburton, they run the country. You know, they didn't even wait like the rest of us to go through their security.
Well, the other thing is, when there's no oversight, I mean, it seems that a couple or maybe four Blackwater people are the ones who got us in a real mess in Fallujah. I mean, it sounds to me like we just have a whole bunch of people there accountable to no one. Not that, frankly, Bush is controlling our troops so well, but what is there, 100,000 contractors?
Well, there probably is closer, and that's a bad. We have no idea, because you give the contract to the company, and then they hire who they want. And that's right. I mean, the fact of the matter is that they don't listen to the military, and then these guys went into Fallujah. They were told not to do that. They get captured and killed, and their bodies maimed, and so then the president orders the Marines to go into Fallujah. And they're not subject, you know, to any type of criminal prosecution if they do something wrong, because they're not,
you know,
in the
military. Code of military justice doesn't apply.
Well, they
to them.
Finally changed the law a little bit that you can do it. But again, it's hard. You got a commander over there. The last thing he wants to do is, you know, launch a case against some private civilians. So it really has gotten out of hand, not just the cost, but what they do and the problems that they're causing. And hopefully we can sit back and say, you know, let's, you know, cut down the use of these people. And let's make sure that before you go to war again, you understand the costs and benefits. If you don't have enough people, you shouldn't do it. And if you're not willing to go back to conscription, I mean, you really would need a draft to fight this war the way Bush wanted to do it.
Was Ronald Reagan more judicious in the use of force?
Oh, very definitely. I mean, when, you know, it's...
I mean, he went to Grenada, right?
Well, I mean, the interesting, when we went into Grenada, the military gave him the plan for how many troops would be needed, and he doubled it. He said, because you don't want to take any chances. What Rumsfeld did is he cut it in half. You know, I mean, and again, that's prudent. You can argue whether you should or not.
And they fired Eric Shinseki for wanting more as well.
Well, they didn't actually fire him. I mean, what happened is they ignored him. They ignored him. And, you know, Wolfowitz, who was a darn draft dodger, said, well, Shinseki doesn't know what he's talking about. And I'm thinking, you do? You know, he had never been in the service. Shinseki had, you know, was in Vietnam, ran the peacekeeping in the Balkans.
You were telling me before you sat down here that the Center of American Progress actually worked out a strategy in Iraq?
Yeah, we did. We in September 2005, my colleague and I, Brian Katulis, who's an Arabist, understands the region, spent a lot of time there, wrote a plan called Strategic Redeployment. And by the way, that's the term Reagan used when he left Lebanon, and that's where I got the term from.
It means withdrawal with honor.
Well, that's right. It, basically, it means what we said is, look, set a timetable to get out of Iraq and leave forces in Kuwait. You can leave the Marines and the carrier battle groups in the Persian Gulf. Send more forces to Afghanistan, because by being bogged down in Iraq, you're actually undermining your security. And you don't want to, you're redeploying. You're not leaving the region. I mean, and that's key. People say, well, that's an important region. Yeah, it is. That's why we're going to stay there, but not in Iraq. And we said, once you set a date to get out, two things will happen. One, it'll put the Iraqis on notice. They got to get their act together. It also tell the countries in the region, it's your problem as well as ours. And none of them want to see Iraq become a failed state. They'll have refugees pouring in. I mean, if it becomes a haven for groups like Al-Qaeda, Iran's not going to like that. They're Persian Shias, and the Al-Qaeda is Sunni Arabs.
Part of the problem in Iraq, and it kind of reminds me of the analogy of you're sitting there and a guy says, oh, there's a terrible beehive, you know, a couple bees have stung me. And so he takes his stick and he's about to whack the beehive. And you say, no, don't do that. That'll make it worse. And he says, no, I will kill the bees. And he whacks the beehive. And now, of course, instead of two bees, there's thousands of bees. And then, you know, he's busy trying to fight the bees, I guess, with his club. And you say, stop it, go away. And he says, okay. What would you do? It seems to me that's the situation we have in Iraq. There aren't any good choices. And every time I have a Republican on my show, and that's one of the things I regularly do is debate Bush supporters, they say, all right, let's not talk about how we got into this mess. How would you get out? So the argument that they make is if we do strategic redeployment, in other words, if we withdraw from Iraq, there's going to be chaos, there's going to be genocide, there's going to be a haven for Al-Qaeda. All these parade of horribles are going to happen. How do you address that argument?
Well, I think two ways. Number one, these are the same arguments they gave before they went in. If you didn't do this, all these horrible things would happen. There's no guarantee. I'd agree. There's no good options because of the way they whacked the beehive. And so you don't have any good options. This is the least bad. You know, if you say, you know, we have two interests in that in Iraq. Number one, that it doesn't become a haven for Al-Qaeda. Now, how do you prevent that? Well, if you're in the region, let's say they set up camps like they did in Afghanistan, you can bomb them. You know how we caught Zarqawi, who was the head of Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia? The information came to the Iraqis. They gave it to us, and we bombed them. Okay, so we could still do that. Could you, and the other interest is we don't want whatever violence is there to spill over into the rest of the region. That's why you got to work with the other countries in the region. Now, if you give a deadline to get out and the Iraqis don't get their act together, it doesn't matter how long you stay, because when you leave, if they haven't had reconciliation, they'll fight it out. And you know, we would hope that they wouldn't. But even so, it's not going to be that bad because none of the groups can really overwhelm the other. The Shias have several militias. The Sunnis have, you know, their own militias. So the idea that there'll be horrible genocide, it's not like you're going to have one party that just can overwhelm the others.
Now, all the evidence on the ground, from what I've heard, and you've been to Iraq, I haven't, is that we are pretty much planning permanent bases there. That the bases we have built in Iraq are not exactly tents. They are firm, concrete military bases. Is that true? And if that's true, what does that say about at least the president's decision to stay in Iraq?
Well, they look permanent. And that's why I think you've got to announce that you're getting out and that you will not maintain permanent bases in Iraq. Because as long as you do, you're going to be perceived as occupiers, and the opinion of the United States and the Muslim world and Iraq. The Iraqis will fight any foreigners, not just us, any foreigners. They'll fight. And, you know the administration would like to stay there. That's why they floated the Korean, you know, the South Korean
model.
Right,
we could be there 50 years or so,
they seem to think. Yeah, so, yeah, they look. I mean, the airfield at Balad is the second longest airfield in the world. I mean, you know, these are very, very permanent, bases.
Is our troop level in Iraq, 150,000 troops, maybe 100,000 contractors, it always strikes me that's 250,000 people. And in Afghanistan, we have about 15,000. And people don't realize this. I talk about it on my show all the time. Afghanistan is 50% larger than Iraq. It has 50% larger population. And frankly, because of its mountains, it's harder to defend inch per inch than Iraq. Is the war in Iraq harming our effort in Afghanistan to fight the Taliban, to find Osama bin Laden, do those kinds of things?
Well, very definitely, because not only did we take troops out in early 2002, we just shifted the focus of people, you know, conducting the operations to Iraq. And, you know, even if you're the central commander or the national security advisor, there's only so many hours in the day that you can focus on. And there's no doubt that had we stayed in Afghanistan longer and focused more on it, put more troops in, things would be better. That is the central front.
Will we have caught Osama bin Laden?
You might have. Well, what happened was Tora Bora, we tried to have the Afghans do it instead of us. I think if we had done it, we'd have had a much better chance. Are there any guarantees? No.
Anything we should do in Pakistan? I mean, everyone seems to think, and, you know, Osama and I don't talk very much. I mean, if we did, I'd probably be in Guantanamo Bay right now. But everyone seems to think he's in Pakistan in some border area. Is there anything we can do? It's such a touchy situation. You've got Musharraf, who's a dictator, but he's our dictator. How do you deal with that?
Well, I think what you'd need to do is make it clear to Musharraf, if he doesn't, help us in dealing with the Taliban in Pakistan, he's not going to get the aid that we promise him. That's our main lever. And, you know, this is ironic because the administration said, well, we went to Iraq to bring democracy. But, well, okay, if you're for democracy, why are you dealing with Musharraf?
Or Saudi Arabia or any of our other allies in the region.
That's right.
One concern that a lot of people have is the Iraqis that went out on the limb to support the United States, to translate for our troops, that frankly are afraid that if we leave, they'll be massacred. I'll give you my idea and then see if you like it. I have long since, actually, I've supported this way back since the first Gulf War. I've supported an independent Kurdish state in the north. I think the Kurds actually are pro-American. They've got some oil. They are a separate people. They are not the ones killing our troops. And frankly, they don't have a state. And that might be a place where Iraqis that supported us might go. What do you think is the and then people talk about Turkey. I got my own solution there. My view is that if you could get the Kurds to give up all Kurdish territory in Turkey, you might just get an agreement where both sides get something. They get a state and Turks get a permanent border. This idea never seems to go anywhere. It's my own personal thing. There are a few people that have it. Is there a possibility, do you think, of an independent Kurdistan in the future?
Well, there's always a possibility, but the problem you have is the Kurds think that they need to control Kirkuk. And you've got several hundred thousand Arabs and Turkmen there. And you're going to have a big battle later this year if they don't have the election that will allow them to take it over, or if you do have the election. And that's a very critical thing that people haven't paid attention to. I think what the Kurds want, they recognize they don't want to be completely independent because they understand, you know, with the Turks. But they don't care if they don't have the form, as long as they have the essence where they can control their own destiny.
Well, but they had it, right? I mean, under Saddam Hussein with the no-fly
zone. Well, they got
it
now. They got it now. I mean, they got their own militia. It's called the Peshmerga. They got their own oil revenues. Things are great there, you know. So the real problem is going to be Kirkuk. Whether that becomes part of the province of Kurdistan or if they should become independent part of
it. So it sounds like, with the possible exception of Kirkuk, you think there will be a de facto Kurdistan, whether or not it's called an independent state or not.
Well, I mean, it is in the sense, when this is all over, whenever it might be, best you can hope for is a loose federation, okay, and provincial controls. That's why, as part of our plan, we urge the United States, get the hell out of Baghdad and work in the regions with the people. Get all those diplomats out of the green zone and get them, you know, and then help the Iraqis who've helped us get out of the country.
Let me ask you this, last question. You worked for the Reagan administration. You clearly are very critical of this administration. Do you think that other... And I don't know whether you still can say yourself a Republican or not, is this a question I can ask you?
Sure.
Or are you a Democrat now or an independent?
Well, I tell people I'm the last living Eisenhower Republican.
Okay.
I'm a Rockefeller Republican.
Fine, but that doesn't mean you can vote for anyone in the Republican Party today.
Well, no, I mean, I couldn't vote for...
Chris Shays, I'll give you him. But
Chris Shays is a good friend of mine.
That's about the only one left.
I like, you know, Chris, and I would take a look at the candidates. I mean, I voted for George Elder Bush against Clinton.
Well, but let me ask you this. Do you see a movement among former Eisenhower Republicans, former Reagan Republicans, of people who are upset by the conduct of this war? Is it just you, Lawrence Korb, or are you the tip of the iceberg?
No, you got people like Brent Scowcroft, Jim Baker. I mean,
not Jim Baker. He's not turning against George.
Well, I mean, not public, but look, when he did the Iraq Study Group, he tried to throw him a lifeline, okay? And the Iraq Study Group is, you know, said, hey, you got to start working with the other countries. Got to put pressure on the Iraqis. Got to set benchmarks and all that. Remember, it was Brent Scowcroft was the one who told them not to go in.
So I guess politically, what can the Democratic Party do to attract people like Lawrence Karb, or maybe not Jim Baker, he's a good friend of the family, but people with those kinds of views?
Well, I think by putting up a candidate who has a realistic view of how to protect U.S. security interests, recognizes the limits of American power, realizes that stability has to come before democracy when you're, you know, looking at events in the world.
I got a candidate for you that can do all of that.
Who's that?
Al Gore.
Well, certainly Gore. I mean, the country would have been a hell of a lot better. I voted for Gore in 2000.
As did the majority of us.
Yes.
Well, that's my own personal hope. Okay. I think he's actually someone who can not only unite all wings of the Democratic Party, but pull over a lot of independents and even Republicans.
But look at Gore was for the first Persian Gulf War.
Yes, he was.
And against the second.
As
he was right
was
both
I.
He was right both times.
Yes, he was. Thank you very much for coming
here
on the Inside.
Okay. Take care.
Well, that was Lawrence Karb. You heard it. I thought he was very, very interesting, gives a lot of insight. One of the things, I like to do on the Inside Scoop is to give you the details. A lot of times you hear talk radio hosts, not just the conservatives, but sometimes the liberal ones as well, on certain rival networks to the Head On Radio Network. They just don't give the details. They have the passion, but they don't have the knowledge. So one of the nice things about my guests, David Korn and Larry Karb, is they both have the knowledge, and hopefully you'll save this show. It's in the archive at radioinsidescoop.com, and you'll be able to refer to it when you need those kinds of details. If you want to call in, there is some time to do so. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. If you don't call in, though, I have a pleasure to have the founder of Code Pink, Medea Benjamin, my interview with her right after the break. We'll be right back after this.
You missed Strictly Confidential last week. You missed Gay Fashion Tips.
So I'm sitting here in my Florida State University t-shirt and my pajama bottoms.
You missed what gay DJs named their dogs.
Disco and Boogie are their names.
You missed Lesbian Bible Study.
And that's my favorite line, too, out of the Bible. Like, thou shalt not lie with a man, so I don't. So what's up with that?
You missed Kiss and Tell.
And this big, tall, handsome Air Force sergeant bent down and kissed me, and I didn't wash my lips for weeks.
You missed The Pursuit of Happiness.
Are you attached, Mom?
Well, see, now this is Strictly Confidential, isn't it?
Tune in Monday through Friday at 9 p.m. Eastern for Strictly Confidential, gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered conversation radio, exclusively on the Head On Radio Network. You know you want to. Stand by your man.
There's one place on the web you can go that's so topical you can apply it liberally. WD40.com. WDYAD40.com. Clyde Wally and Dookie are there. They're working hard every day to give you updates in news, politics, and a great sense of humor. So stop on by and see the boys at WD40.com, a place where you can raise your voice and be heard. WD40.com. Your one-stop shop for all things progressive.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. We go from the knowledge of David Korn and Larry Karb to the passion of Medea Benjamin.
I'm sitting here with Medea Benjamin. She is the co-founder of Code Pink. Code Pink is in force at the Campaign for America's Future. You see them everywhere in bright pink, wearing 3,528 U.S. on their shirts and making the very loud case that we need to leave Iraq Medea Benjamin, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hey, nice to be here.
So you organize this unruly group that we see here.
You organize them, but then they take off on their own.
I can see that. It's probably like herding cats.
It's sort of like creating monsters. Once you empower these women, they just go wild.
How long has Code Pink been around?
We started before the war in Iraq. We started right after the invasion of Afghanistan, seeing that there were a lot of innocent civilians that were being killed in that invasion, and then hearing the drumbeats for going to war in Iraq, we said, no, Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, we can't go there. And we've been fighting this ever since.
You seem to be growing as a movement.
We are. It's pretty amazing. You know, we started out not trying to do anything but like an action here or there against the war, about six of us. And suddenly we turn around and we had a march that had brought 10,000 people to the nation's capital. And then we turned around, we had 250 local groups around the country. You can look at our website, codepinkalert.org, and see that we've got locals in all the 50 states, and now we have a lot of them in other countries as well. So I think without really trying all that hard, we have spawned a movement of not just women, a lot of men in Code Pink as well, but people who
men can wear pink.
Outrageous, that's right. And men look very nice in pink, I must say.
So what are you doing here at the Campaign for America's Future? Are you trying to keep the Democratic Party leaders in line? Well, what's
that's
your goal?
Exactly it. You know, we feel that a lot of people worked very hard to change the leadership in Congress last November and thought that when the Democrats came in, we were going to see significant changes in the most important issue to the electorate, and that's the war in Iraq. Then, lo and behold, we see them turn around and give another $95 billion to keep this war going. So a lot of people around this country are disillusioned with the Democrats, are angry with them, and we're here to say if you don't want to lose support, if you want to win the White House, you better start producing something and don't just blame it on the Republicans. Yes, we blame the Republicans. They're the ones who got us into this war. But we blame the Democrats for having gone along with them for a long time, and still to this day, all too many Democrats continue to go along with this war.
Well, what are people telling you? I don't know if you've met with the various presidential candidates and so forth. Have you? And if so, what have they told you?
Well, each of the candidates is very different. We
and Dennis Kucinich,
yeah,
I'm sure, has no
right
problem
on.
With you.
I think we give him 100%
right.
Mark.
But the other candidates, what are they telling you?
Well, Bill Richardson has a very good position. John Edwards has a good position on the war in Iraq, but he has making up for it with his bellicose remarks about Iran and saying that we've got to stop them and there's no option off the table. The same with Hillary Clinton. Now, it's amazing. We've been bird-dogging her intensely for almost 2 years now.
I saw that just today in her speech. I wasn't sure whether it was y'all that were causing the ruckus there.
Oh, you can kind of always know that that's us because we tend to go to her fundraisers, her press conferences.
What's your goal?
Our goal with Hillary has been to get her to come out against the war. Now, we were very tame today in her talk because she actually, thanks to the pressure she feels around the country, voted against funding the war in the last vote.
Against
the
supplemental.
Which is a big change. It's a sea change for her. Last year, she was here at this very same conference and said that she thinks it would be wrong to have a timetable for withdrawal from Iraq. This year, she's here saying,
time
we
to come
need
home.
A timetable.
Yeah, no, she said it very clearly in her speech.
So she has moved, and I would say it's the pressure that has made her move. So we've got to keep putting the pressure on her because, you know, she tends to backtrack. She says the same things like nothing is off the table in terms of Iran. She says that we're safer since 9/11, which is absolutely crazy and certainly not even what the CIA says. So we have to keep the pressure on her, but we, of course, have to put the pressure on these Republican candidates who say terrible things about keeping the troops in Iraq, about winning this war that's unwinnable, and they, too, talk about going into Iran.
Now, does Code Pink go to conservative events? Do you ever go to Republican campaigns and disrupt those?
Well, we're actually famous for having infiltrated the Republican National Convention on every single night of that convention, getting thrown out in the middle of the speeches by not only my Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, but also Dick Cheney and George Bush himself. We infiltrated the inauguration and got up way close to George Bush and started yelling about he needs to get us out of Iraq. We go into the offices of Republican congresspeople. We have been kicked out of many an office, including arrested at offices like John McCain's. So you can't accuse us of just focusing on the Democrats. We did a four-month vigil in front of the White House every day in the snow and the cold. Then that wasn't good enough. We did a hunger strike for a month in front of the White House. That wasn't good enough. Then we had the change of Congress, and now we tend to focus more on Congress.
Will Code Pink endorse a candidate for president?
No, we don't want to endorse a candidate for president. We want to keep pushing on the issues. Right now, we're pushing all of the candidates. We've been handing out a sheet here on the Republican and Democrat candidates' remarks about Iran to say it's really hard for us to get out of this war. Let's stop the next one before it starts. We're going on the campaign trail with the message to get out of Iraq and don't take us into Iran. And we'll continue to do that throughout this presidential campaign.
Medea Benjamin, thank you for coming here on the Inside Scoop.
Thanks very much. And if people want to join us, we're at codepinkalert.org. And that includes men, especially ones who are manly enough to wear pink.
As all men should. Thank you, Medea.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed my interviews today. There will be more of them tomorrow. So really some fantastic interviews, including presidential candidate Mike Gravel, and the vice chairman of the Democratic Party, Susie Turnbull, Ned Lamont, our hero in Connecticut, and the Maryland gubernatorial candidate, Kathleen Kennedy Townsend. That's all tomorrow. For now, this is Mark Levine signing off.
This is the Quality News Network. Senator John McCain's presidential run suffered a major setback today with the resignation of his campaign manager and political strategist. The shakeup comes 6 months before the Iowa caucuses. McCain's popularity dropped significantly this year as he embraced President Bush's troop increase for the Iraq War. The president is expected to defend his Iraq war strategy while in Cleveland today. Senior administration officials say Bush does not plan to make any changes to his plan, despite growing disapproval from both Democrats and Republicans. The White House says the last of the additional troops just arrived 2 weeks ago and calls for withdrawal are premature. A high-ranking Democrat proposed legislation to begin bringing U.S. troops home in 120 days and end combat by the end of April 2008. The measure, spearheaded by Senator Carl Levin, chairman of the Armed Services Committee, would allow for some troops to stay in Iraq on counterterrorism efforts. Five people were killed earlier today when a small plane crashed into two homes near Orlando. The twin-engine Cessna was en route to Lakeland, Florida, when it encountered problems and attempted to land at Orlando's International Airport. The crash also started two house fires that critically burned three people. In Islamabad, a leading radical cleric from the pro-Taliban Red Mosque was killed when he refused to surrender. After negotiations broke down earlier today, Pakistani troops stormed the compound, killing the cleric and over 50 militants. Eight soldiers were also killed during the raid. In Afghanistan, 17 civilians were killed and another 30 wounded when a suicide bomber blew himself up close to a NATO convoy in the southern part of the country. An extremist Taliban group with ties to Al-Qaeda claimed responsibility for the attack. Oakland Airport was shut down for 2 hours this morning after a security breach. Airport